From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. As Richard Alpert, he was one of the early researchers of LSD. As Ram Dass, he introduced many Americans to Eastern spirituality. On today's Fresh Air, Ram Dass tells us why he got rid of his robes and his beard, and why he started pursuing service as a form of spiritual discipline. Poet Allen Ginsberg and composer Philip Glass both practiced Buddhism, and now they're collaborating on a new music theater piece. Coming up, Glass and Ginsberg tell us what they're learning from each other. And linguist Jeffrey Nunberg shares his second thoughts about word processors. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. A Palestinian terrorist group said today that it's preparing to release an American hostage within the next 48 hours. The group, the Islamic Jihad for the Liberation of Palestine, is believed to be holding three Americans. NPR's Ann Garrels has details.
In a handwritten statement, the kidnappers demand that Assistant Secretary of State John Kelly fly to Damascus to resolve the final steps of the release within the next 48 hours. Kelly is currently in West Germany, and U.S. officials will only say there are no plans for him to travel to the Middle East at this time. The kidnapper statement appears to demand some kind of unspecified quid pro quo, and the response by the Bush administration has been cautious. A State Department spokesman said the United States would welcome the unconditional release of the hostages, stressing the word unconditional to rebut suggestions a deal might be afoot. Officials believe regional politics are the reason for today's message. Iranian President Rafsanjani insists Iran has no direct links to the hostages, but he's made it clear he would now like to resolve the hostage issue and remove obstacles to improved relations with the West. Until now, he's not been able to overcome opposition from hardliners in Iran and Lebanon. I'm Ann Garrels in Washington.
Officials in Lithuania said today that the Soviet Union has made good on its threat to impose economic sanctions on the breakaway republic by shutting off the supply of oil to Lithuania's only refinery. The move came just hours after the Soviet deputy oil and gas minister told the official news agency that reports of an energy cutoff to Lithuania were groundless. Lithuania is entirely dependent on the Soviet Union for all oil and gas. Earlier today, Secretary of State James Baker repeated warnings that the use of force or coercion by the Soviets in Lithuania could jeopardize superpower relations. The British government says that the steel pipe seized by customs last week were part of a giant gun bound for Iraq. Vera Frankel reports from London.
For 8 days now, there's been a continuing debate about the real nature of a batch of steel pipes impounded by British customs on a ship bound for Iraq. From the first, customs investigators suspected that the British-made pipes were part of a huge gun to be assembled in Iraq. The Iraqi government denied the charge. So too did the British firm which made the pipes, insisting they were for a petrochemical project. But today, Trade and Industry Secretary Nicholas Ridley said the government was sure the pipes were part of a long-range weapon. He said he could not give further details because inquiries into possible criminal offences were still continuing. Britain has had an embargo on arms sales to Iraq since the Gulf War. For National Public Radio, this is Vera Frankel in London.
Stock prices fell today on Wall Street, driven down by a sell-off in the Treasury bond market. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 32 points to close at 2,733. Declines led advances 5-2. This is NPR News. Lawyers close to the racketeering and securities fraud case of Michael Milken say the former junk bond king appears to be nearing a plea bargain agreement with federal prosecutors. Milken, the former head of the junk bond division of Drexel Burnham Lambert, faces a 98-count indictment on charges of insider trading. The government has said it'll pursue even broader charges against Milken, and sources familiar with the case say that a plea bargain wouldn't necessarily preclude a new indictment. If Milken's found guilty of even one racketeering count, he could be sent to prison for 20 years. Technicians at the Kennedy Space Center this morning test-fired the Shuttle Discovery's new auxiliary power unit, and the results were good enough to push the launch schedule ahead by 1 day. Dave Pignanelli with member station WMFE has more.
Shuttle launch managers at the Kennedy Space Center met this afternoon and then emerged with a new liftoff date for Discovery and its payload, the Hubble Space Telescope. Tuesday, April 24th is the new target date, 1 day sooner than planned. NASA's George Diller says the new date was the result of positive test data received from this morning's firing.
With the auxiliary power unit changeout not having run into any problems, and with the battery charging on the Hubble Space Telescope batteries getting started early, that meant that the whole flow was moving up to a day early.
The original power unit had failed just 4 minutes before liftoff last week and had to be replaced. Technicians will install newly charged batteries aboard Hubble at the end of this week. Launch time Tuesday is set for 8:31 Eastern Time. For National Public Radio, I'm Dave Pignanelli in Orlando.
American Telephone and Telegraph Company today defended its decision to end funding for a Planned Parenthood program. The company recently decided to end its $50,000 a year support for a Planned Parenthood program to combat teen pregnancy. Some shareholders and customers had complained that the funding amounted to support for abortion. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest has made an impact on American culture through his early experiments with LSD and as a spiritual leader. In the early 1960s, Richard Alpert was a Harvard professor of psychology conducting clinical research into the use of psychedelics. He and his colleague, Timothy Leary, were fired from Harvard in 1963. After continuing the experiments off campus, in 1967, Alpert went to India, where he met his guru and studied yoga and meditation. His spiritual teacher gave him a new name, Ram Dass, and when Ram Dass returned to the States, he was perceived as something of a guru himself. His 1971 book of advice, Be Here Now, became a bestseller. Now Ram Dass describes himself as pursuing service as a form of spiritual discipline. In 1978, he co-founded the group SEVA, a service organization that supports health and environmental organizations in developing countries and assists Native American groups in the U.S. When Richard Alpert became Ram Dass, his father mocked the change, and there was an enormous rift between the hippie hero's son and the father who had served as president of the New York, New Haven, and Hartford Railroad. Ram Dass's father died last year at the age of 90, and in the last years of his life, Ram Dass lived with his father and cared for him when Ram Dass wasn't on the road. I asked what was responsible for the change in their relationship.
Well, both of us changed. As he got older, he mellowed, he deepened, he quieted. His personality changed a lot. And I also saw that honoring him, honoring my family, was part of my route to freedom. That we had a concept of freedom in the 60s that pushed away family. We got so obsessed with independence and individualism that we lost something of the richness that comes from family. Not only don't you have built-in babysitters, but you just don't have a built-in emotional support system. And when I came back to take care of Dad and took care of my stepmother through her death and all that, I felt tremendously enriched by it. I felt that these were gifts that were given to me. And that when I turned my heart around and saw and honored the fact, there was a point in my life where I realized that I had to honor my incarnation. That it wasn't my enemy, it was my vehicle, it was my curriculum, if you will. And then he became part of my curriculum. And then getting straight with him became part of the way I got free, because as long as you push something away, it's got you.
We're talking about pushing back your father. It strikes me in your own way you pushed back your own life, even by changing your name and by changing your whole public identity.
Exactly. In fact, those first years were basically a renunciate path. Of renouncing my humanity, renouncing my sexual desires, renouncing my social, my family, my nation-state identity, all of those identities. And there was a certain point where I realized that I could get high that way, but if I wanted to be free, free meant not turning away from anything. It meant being free in the midst of it all.
What did you most want to renounce about yourself, your past, you know, your identity?
I think I wanted to renounce my lack of compassion for the have-nots that came out of my middle-class fears. I think I feel, you know, people feel impoverished from their childhood for a lot of reasons. I feel impoverished from my childhood because I didn't grow up in a family that had great social concerns. I mean, we were charitable, but we weren't really caring in that way. You know,
when you first returned to the States as Baba Ram Dass after you had studied with your spiritual teacher in India, and you came here with a new name and with robes and a long beard,
None of which I have now, by the way.
Yeah, I should mention that.
For those of you who don't see me.
That's right. You're wearing civilian clothes, a trimmed mustache. Why did you don the clothes and the beard? That's kind of like the prototypical guru look.
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you, when you're new to something and you're trying to change the way you are in a social structure, if you have symbols that lead people to treat you differently, it helps. And when I walk down the street with beard and beads and barefoot and this long dress like a pharaoh, it was hard for people to treat me the way they would treat another person. And it kind of left an open space for me to adopt a new identity. It was a functional costume. It was like a chameleon type thing.
You told us a couple of the benefits of wearing, you know, the kind of guru garb. What were some of the problems that it brought? Did it bring any?
Well, the problem is the same problem that I have with the name Ram Dass now, is that it turns off a lot of people that could be people with whom I could share our shared awareness or awakening or our social concerns or our ecological concerns, that I'm seen as a cult person because of the label or the dress or the things like that. And I think it alienated people unnecessarily. I think that was part of it. I think it also made people put you into a category immediately, which then they had a set of responses or reactions to your category. And I think being more ambiguous is more interesting in terms of giving people a chance to explore new places in their own heads.
You say that Ram Dass, for some people, puts you into a certain category. Didn't you at one point change your name back to Richard Alpert?
I tried, but it didn't seem to work. I was so used to being Ram Dass in people's minds. My publisher didn't want to do it. They said it wouldn't sell books. And the other part of it was that Ram Dass is such a beautiful name, and it means servant of God. And now, because I did How Can I Help a few years ago with Paul Gorman, a service book, which is used by nurses and doctors, I've mainstreamed in that way. And then once you mainstream, people overlook the name. It's just kind of irrelevant to them. So I'm a good guy now, so it doesn't matter. When you're a bad guy, it was another reason to be bad.
You did drop the Baba.
Yeah.
What does Baba mean, and why did you drop it?
It means kind of grandfather, elder. It's a term of respect. But all those things, like I've also dropped doctor because I'm a PhD. But all those labels, it seems to me, I just don't feel I need any labels. Why not just be right here?
Ram Dass is my guest, if you're just joining us. Can we go back a bunch of years?
Like
Let's go back to the early 60s when you were Richard Alpert and you were a professor of psychology at Harvard University and were one of the first people, and one of the very first East Coast people, to start experimenting with LSD. Mm-hmm. What use were you putting it to in your official capacity in the university?
Well, I'm a research psychologist, and that's a study of the mind, psyche, logos. And these chemicals are incredible in overriding habitual ways of seeing the universe and allowing a fresh way of perceiving. And they connected me to levels of my awareness that my Western psychological framework didn't cover. And so, just as a student of the mind, I started out with that exploration. In the process of my early experience, I had what later I could acknowledge as spiritual experiences, which for a Western social scientist, spiritual stuff was seen as, like an anthropologist would see or a Freudian would see it, as sublimated something or other, or, you know, the creation of the human mind. But I really tuned into a larger context in which I exist other than my material, sensual thinking context.
So you started using LSD as part of your academic research, but once you started actually taking LSD yourself, that academic research no longer seemed relevant?
Well, I'll tell you, it was because we did studies to show, and I think that it's painful to me that in our zeal to say no to drugs, we have not differentiated between the tryptamines, for example, the psychedelics, which have potential for social change, for use. Like we worked with prisoners in prisons where the recidivism rate is so bad. We working in marriages, working with dying people to help them extricate themselves from identification with being that which dies. There were tremendous potential uses, all of which have been, the research has been wiped out by the society's fear of drugs, other than for liquor and, you know, things like that. But so our research continued to, we started in a naturalistic way because those kind of chemicals were seen in our society as psychotomimetics. That is, they were used by psychiatrists to parallel schizophrenia. And while in other cultures they were used for religious and oracular processes, and we said instead of laying a trip on them, let's just give them to people and get reports back and let's see how they use them and build a new kind of context for them. And then we began to see how set and setting were so important, that a person could have them and have a religious experience. They could use them to escape. They could use them for creative work. They could use them for therapeutic change.
You and Timothy Leary at Harvard started using LSD, and then Ken Kesey on the West Coast started using it, I think in very different ways, in a different setting. Did you have any conflicts with Kesey about what LSD should mean in the society, how it should be used?
Well, we were somewhere in the middle because there were, I mean, we had Aldous Huxley and Alan Watts and all these people. There was a community of us that were researching. And in a way, we were saying, let's keep it reasonably quiet so we can research because it's very controversial and it's going to upset the culture. At the same moment, we were opening the door at Harvard with students and so on. So we were partly responsible. Ken blew it apart in a way with the acid test because he made it a street scene. And that frightened the society so much, it forced the laws, it forced legislation probably a couple of years before it would have happened. And maybe the research could have gotten more entrenched had there been a little more space.
So you still regret that that research wasn't given a chance?
Yeah, I regret it even now. I think it would be wonderful. Not us, but I mean there are a lot of other people that could do research now.
Have you found that it's become more difficult to talk about psychedelic drugs, either in terms of the present or in terms of the research that you did in the past, in the climate today surrounding drugs, where the big fear is really around addictive drugs like
crack and cocaine and heroin. I think it is. It's certainly difficult if I talk in the mass media. There's a lot of reaction. I usually, when I have the opportunity, I really go into the issues of crack and cocaine and show the way in which they are symptoms of a malaise in our society. That in the crack issue is the lack of opportunities, economic opportunities in inner city life. And in the cocaine in the middle class, it's that they've lived out the myths where they thought they would be happy if they won, and then they don't feel that sense of contentment. And part of the myth is more will be better, so they go for the greed quality of more experience. And I think that every technological advance is open to misuse, as we have certainly learned. I mean, and psychedelics is no exception.
Ram Dass is my guest, and he's now the head of the SEVA Foundation, which is a service organization that funds health and environmental groups in developing countries. They fund homeless groups and Native American groups in the U.S. He first became known as Richard Alpert and was one of the early pioneers in LSD experimentation at Harvard University in the early 60s. We'll talk more after we take a short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Ram Dass is my guest, and you were just correcting me while our microphones were off that you are not exactly the head of the SEVA Foundation.
I'm just another member of the board. We have a rotating chairmanship.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, eventually you went to India, studied with a teacher who became your spiritual teacher. Can you tell us something about him and about the kind of spiritual path you took with him?
Well, meeting him was the power of that initially was that everything that I took LSD to touch in my being, I realized he was. In fact, he actually took 900 micrograms of LSD, and nothing happened to him because it's like if you're in Detroit, you don't have to take a bus to Detroit. I mean, he was that quality. He had integrated it. So it showed me the potential that a human being, he showed me what a human being could be in terms of freedom from a fixed model of himself and a quality of love that was, I experienced as unconditional because he was resting in a place in himself where he didn't want anything from me. He didn't want my money. He didn't want anything. He didn't want my love. He didn't want anything from me. He didn't even want me to change. He didn't want anything. And I had never been in the presence of somebody who didn't want something from me. I mean, that was a big thing for me. That opened my heart a great deal. And he died in 1973, and I would say he is the most real, I don't know how to say it, entity in my consciousness still, now. That once you have a friend like that who has that quality of compassion and has that quality of emptiness and that quality of the giggle, the cosmic giggle, you just carry that with you, and that's the way in which he continues to influence my life.
There have been so many, both American and foreign spiritual teachers who have been responsible for terrible corruption and for many deaths.
Yeah.
In the United States, what do you think has gone wrong there? And I'm sure it's something you've thought about because it's the kind of thing that makes people suspicious in general spiritual leaders.
I don't blame them. I think that Easterners that have come to the West are very vulnerable to the culture. For example, in the East, if you're a Hindu sadhu, the women and men are very segregated in the temple scene. Here, they're not. Here, women embrace you. You're not used to that if you're living in the East. You're very vulnerable. You haven't built protective devices for handling that or for learning how to socialize that or deal with it. And I think many of them just fell by the wayside. They just weren't used to the onslaught of desire provocation that our advertising, that our lifestyle is about. And I think that there is a... we in the West are so enamored of power, and a lot of yogis develop what are called siddhis or powers in the East. And they come here, and that power starts to be a card of entree to all kinds. They can read minds, they can do stuff, and then they start to use the power. And one of the rules of yoga is when you develop the powers, don't use them. Let them happen through you sometimes, but don't you use them because they will corrupt you. And I think that's where a lot of them fell, in the corruption of their intention to use their power, even when they thought they were doing it for good, by the way.
Have you had your defenses up, so to speak, because there's been, you know, the chance of a cult of personality developing around you, whether you intended it or not?
I think my guru protected me a lot. He said, Ram Dass, no ashrams, no monasteries. And what I've learned is I have no students, I have no disciples, I have no place people come to. I'm a wandering, you know, person. I just come, I feel I'm a networker. My image of myself, which I tell the audiences all the time, is I am a mouthpiece for a process a lot of us are going through. And my job is to say it well. And that's it. I'm a networking agent. I am not an enlightened being. I am not a guru. And in that way, then if they say, isn't he humble, and he is, and they project it, that's their projections, then what I have to learn to live with is not to buy other people's projections. And that's a good art for all of us to learn, how to see a projection coming at you of, oh, how great you are, or, oh, you're an irresponsible fool because you used drugs one time, and let the other people's minds' projections go through you sort of like Chinese food, you know, instead of grabbing at you and holding on.
I want to talk with you a little bit about sexuality because I know that that's been an important issue throughout the different stages of your life. When you first started becoming very spiritually involved, you became celibate for a while. What was your reasons for choosing celibacy?
I think that the model of celibacy is very strong in the East, and it's based on the idea that that there are certain desire systems in the human animal that are so strong that it's very hard to extricate your awareness from an identification with those desire systems. So the best thing to do is to keep away from them, to segregate yourself from them, and to deny them. Okay? Then I realized that in the West, that leads to what I call the horny celibate syndrome. Okay? And that led me to the next stage, realizing I have to have commerce with that. I have to find peace. I have to be able to acknowledge the desires without getting lost in an identification with them. And that opened me to another chapter of my life, okay? And I'm bisexual, and that has led me, in a way, that has been extraordinary because since my early homosexuality segregated me from the society, because when I was experiencing that in my early years, you were closeted for it. That built a lot of compassion into me for what minority group and what segregation persecution is about. It has also made me very, very open to the AIDS issue, not in a personal sense, but in the sense of being empathetic with the nature of the sexual desires that led to, for the gay community, to the predicament they find themselves in.
You've been working a lot with people who have AIDS.
And I also train buddies, and I've been helping set up hospices, for residential hospices for AIDS people to die in.
I want to ask you a question about your father, who we were talking about earlier. He died in the past year. You had been living with him when you weren't on the road and helping to take care of him. I don't know how he was when he died, but at one point in his life, he was a wealthy man. Was there an inheritance, and how did you decide to use it?
My guru said to me early on, he said, "Your father has money?" I said, "Yes." He said, "He's going to leave it to you?" I said, "Well, he's going to leave me a portion of it." He said, "You're not to accept your inheritance." I said, "Boy, that's interesting. I mean, to tell that to a Jewish boy is something, you know." I couldn't tell my father because he had raised it, you know, earned it for his kids. And he trusted me so much, he made me the executor and all of that. But what I've done is I divided what went to my brothers and my nieces and nephew, and then the rest of it I've given away.
So you never told him that you weren't going to personally accept it?
No, I felt that that would be hurting him.
So you thought it was okay to not tell him the complete truth about this?
Never asked me.
Okay.
He just assumed. But there was some subtle thing that happened between us, because the minute my guru said that, that money no longer was mine. And in some deep psychological way, that changed my relationship to my father. After that, I wanted him to spend his money. I wanted him to, you know, there was no longer my money that he was using. And I helped him get married. I gave away the bride in his second marriage. I was close friends with him. I helped them enjoy themselves as much as I could. And he sensed that. He sensed that I didn't want something from him. And I think that's why he trusted me to give me power of attorney, to make me executor, you know, as I'm not a lawyer. And so...
Not wanting something from you. That's what you said you felt towards your teacher, that he didn't want anything from
you. Exactly.
That's very important to you.
It's quite an art, isn't it? Yeah, it's quite an art.
Thank you very much for talking with us.
A pleasure, Terry.
Ram Dass is co-founder of the Seva Foundation. He's currently on a national lecture tour. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, theater and film director Peter Brook. He staged a 9-hour production of the Indian sacred text, the Mahabharata. Now he's adapted it into a film. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. We're listening to music by composer Philip Glass. Glass is collaborating with poet Allen Ginsberg on a new music theater piece that will receive its concert premiere later this month at the American Music Theater Festival in Philadelphia. Coming up, these two groundbreaking artists talk with us about working together. Also, our linguist Jeffrey Nunberg thinks about how writers are helped and hurt by word processors. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. Supplies of Soviet oil to Lithuania's key refinery were halted tonight, moments after the Parliament of Lithuania repeated its refusal to rescind any of its laws passed since its March 11th independence declaration. Benjamin Rowe has more from Moscow.
Workers at the Mažeikiai refinery reported the flow of crude oil was halted shortly after 9:30 p.m., confirming yesterday's statement by Lithuanian Prime Minister Kazimiera Prunskiene that a cutoff was imminent. Tonight, Prunskiene and Foreign Minister Algirdas Saudargas flew to Norway in their drive to find fuel sources alternate from Moscow. The cutoff happened just as the parliament had voted to tell Soviet President Mikhail Gorbachev that it stood by its independence laws, but welcomed renewed dialogue with the Kremlin. As a conciliatory gesture, the lawmakers offered a two-week moratorium on new legislation. The resolution also urged the Soviet leadership to renounce its economic violence against the Lithuanians and urged the citizens and industries of the republic to prepare themselves for restricted consumption and spiritual endurance in the face of an economic blockade. The Soviet media had earlier denied any moves to disrupt the supply of energy to the republic. For National Public Radio, I'm Benjamin Rowe in Moscow.
In Beirut, a pro-Iranian group says that it will free one of three Americans it's holding hostage. However, the White House has turned down one demand of the hostage takers, that a senior U.S. diplomat fly to Syria to coordinate the release. The Islamic Jihad for the Liberation of Palestine holds Jesse Turner, Alan Steen, and Robert Polehill. Today's statement came with a photograph of Turner. In South Africa today, President F.W. de Klerk announced the appointment of a judicial commission of inquiry into the police shooting of black protesters last month. John Madison reports from Johannesburg.
The shooting of demonstrators in Sebokeng, a black township south of Johannesburg last month, led Nelson Mandela to suspend proposed talks with the government. Those talks have been rescheduled for May 2nd, and this commission will investigate whether the police used excessive force. Many members of the police in South Africa are supporters of the far-right political parties and paramilitary groups that oppose negotiations with the black majority. Today it was announced that a significant theft of arms and ammunition was discovered at Air Force headquarters in Pretoria. The arms included dozens of pistols, machine guns, and heavy guns. Officials are looking for a right-wing politician and former Pretoria City Councillor in connection with the theft. Various right-wing groups have threatened violence to stop the successful conclusion of talks with black leaders. I'm John Matheson in Johannesburg.
In New York City on Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down almost 33 points to close at 2,732.88 on volume of 147 million shares. Declining issues led advances 2-1 in moderate trading. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. Philip Glass has set the poems of Allen Ginsberg to music in a new work called Hydrogen Jukebox. The piece has its world premiere at the Spoleto Festival in South Carolina and will have its concert premiere later this month at the American Music Theater Festival in Philadelphia. Yesterday, the composer and the poet were in Chicago, where they did a benefit performance for the Buddhist group Jewel Heart. They came to the NPR Bureau in Chicago to talk with us about working together. Allen Ginsberg started off the story of how they met.
Well, let's see. My first contact with this collaboration was in the St. Mark's Bookshop in New York City when Philip Glass and I bumped into each other. And what did you tell me then?
Well, the Avetco Company, which is a theater company that was organized by Tom Bird, it's a Vietnam Veterans Theater Company, had asked me to participate in a benefit. And I suggested that maybe I could do something with you, and they asked me whether we could get some one of your Vietnam period pieces and that I could do some music with. And I ran into your bookstore and I said, Alan, what do you think of this idea?
And then the bookstore had my poems, so I pulled down a copy of, I think, Collected Poems, and pointed out a specific passage which had a lot of musical possibilities because it had big, interesting, melodramatic dynamics. Yeah. And I think I gave it to you or something?
Yeah, at that time. And then
a little copy of the book, that's right, the City Lights book.
You made a recording of it.
Yeah.
I work with the recording, and I made a piano setting for Alan's reading, which was then premiered, I think, that June. We're talking about June of 88 now, mm-hmm. at the Schubert Theater for that benefit.
What was the poem?
Wichita Vortex Sutra, and it was the central passage driving through the middle of Kansas, talking to myself, saying if the president can send troops over there and declare war on Indochina, I can undeclare it, because he doesn't have any legal right, and I haven't got any legal right, so it's simply up to us to assert our different direction of will, so to speak, or our different vision of the universe, and my poetic vision was going to outlast him, I thought. So I here declare the end of the war.
That poem's in your Hydrogen Jukebox,
well,
isn't
it? Turns out to be, because what happened is that after this small collaboration, we enjoyed it a lot, and it was very successful, and I suggested to Alan that we do a longer piece, or he suggested to me, or what.
Well, we were doing a lot of benefits for Buddhist organizations, mm-hmm. Buddhist meditation centers, as we are this week for Jewel Heart in Chicago. And so I thought, well, maybe we should work up a little repertoire so that we wouldn't have to repeat things over ourselves.
Well, the piece we ended up doing, it turned out to be for six singers and a small ensemble, and it covered, a lot of the poems in Collected Poetry. Well, it doesn't cover the poetry.
It covers a span of poems over maybe 30 years, actually.
That mostly are found in Collected Poems.
Alan, can I ask you to read one of the poems that's included in Hydrogen Jukebox? And I'd like you to read the opening of To Aunt Rose.
Okay. Yes,
of your early poems. It's from 1958.
Well, that's 1958, that'd be early. Is Aunt Rose, now might I see you with your thin face and buck-tooth smile and pain of rheumatism and a long black heavy shoe for your bony left leg limping down the long hall in Newark on the running carpet past the black grand piano in the day room where the parties were, and I sang Spanish loyalist songs in a high, squeaky voice, hysterical, the committee listening, while you limped around the room, collected the money, Aunt Honey, Uncle Sam, a stranger with a cloth arm in his pocket, and huge, young, bald head of Abraham Lincoln Brigade.
What was going on in your life and in your writing in 1958 when you wrote this poem?
I was in Paris. My Aunt Rose, this was 1958, my Aunt Rose had died and was buried in Newark in 1940, and now I was all grown up, and I suddenly had a flash on the phantom of my old Aunt Rose, whom I loved a great deal, kind of surrogate mother, and realized it was almost two decades that she'd gone to the Yellow Springs, and suddenly felt a twinge of ancient Parisian nostalgia, for being alive. And an awareness of what a precious thing it was, and how exquisite my memories of her were, and just began talking to her, or thinking of talking to her. I said, "Well, this would make an interesting piece of." I never wrote about this before. How come I never wrote about my dear old Aunt Rose?
And what was going on in your writing?
Well, it was a very productive period. I had come from San Francisco. I was with William Burroughs, Gregory Corso, and Peter Orlovsky in living about half a block from the Seine River in a little tiny furnished room where we all had little rooms, $30 a month, near a market, so we could cook on a one-burner gas stove. And Gregory Corso was writing his poem, Marriage. Burroughs was putting together Naked Lunch. Peter was writing his first poem. I was writing European poems like Nostalgic Recollections of America, or a poem on Apollinaire's Grave, or a poem on the new Sputnik that had just gotten up off the ground. So it was just sort of an American in Paris, classic situation, recalling ancient dead days of New Jersey.
Philip Glass, how much did you talk about this poem with Allen Ginsberg before writing the music
setting
for it?
Specifically, I don't think we talked specifically about it. I'm sure that Alan read it for me, because one of the things that we did together during the month or so that we were putting together the, well, let's call it the libretto of the opera, was to, one of the things we did was sit and, not only did we pick out the poems, but Alan read them to us, or read them for us. One of the things that I was anxious to do, we talked about these themes of, let's say, just generally, like...
Family, in this case, I think.
In this case...
personal matter rather than giant.
Right, we thought that one of the priorities of the piece was the personal as well as the public. So that, and I liked, I liked the poem very much because it was so much about something, a very private part of Alan's world, rather than the very public part that most people maybe know about. I thought of the what has become the Hydrogen Jukebox, which has become Hydrogen Jukebox, as really a portrait of America at the end of the 20th century. And one of the things that I was anxious to do, and one of the reasons I got the idea of launching into this big piece with Alan, was that right after the last presidential elections, when none of the candidates seemed to be willing to talk about the world that we lived in, I wanted to be involved with a piece that really talked about the American landscape that everybody knew about, and that the politicians were seemed to be afraid to talk about.
When you were writing music as a setting for Ginsberg's poems, did it change the lines of your music at
all?
Oh,
sure.
What effect did it have on your lines?
For me, the rhythm of the American language is the key to how these things are said. And just listening to Alan read this last poem, though he'll tell you, I'm sure, that my settings aren't the same as the way he reads it, but it really, on the other hand, they're not that different either. What I was most intent on doing was respecting the music that was already in the words. In other words...
How do you relate your music, which involves a certain amount of mantric repetition, how do you relate that to the text that's set before you?
Usually, as a kind of screen
against which the music.
There are
the
two
words.
Things. For one thing, there's the words themselves, which need to be said in the most natural way. There is that part, but there's another part to it too, which is the actual musical, let's say, ambience or environment that the words are set into. For example, in the thing about in the poem about Aunt Rose that you just read, what I did is I picked a rhythm which was it was a 5/8 rhythm, 1-2-3, 1-2, 1-2-3, 1-2, kind of a lopsided rhythm, and I got that idea of the rhythm from the description of her foot in the long.
Aunt Rose, now might I see you, Aunt Rose, now
but
might I see.
But it's also the picture of someone who walks with a limp.
Right.
The 1-2-3, dot. It's an uneven walk.
And a long black heavy shoe.
And I thought of the uneven walk of the person in the long shoe, and I thought of the uneven rhythm, and in a way that one specific thing, the only specific relation of the music to the words is that, but it's a very specific one.
Uh-huh.
And once I get one, you see, the thing is that when you do a portrait in music, you don't have to do a complete portrait. All you have to do is an indication. And mostly we, as listeners, will fill in the rest.
So the music and the words intersect.
They really do.
Composer Philip Glass and poet Allen Ginsberg are my guests. Their collaboration, Hydrogen Jukebox, gets its concert premiere later this month at the American Music Theater Festival in Philadelphia. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. Composer Philip Glass and poet Allen Ginsberg are my guests. Philip, what do you think Allen Ginsberg brings out in your work? And Allen, what do you think Philip brings out in your work? Working together, do you think that you are having an influence on each other?
Well, it's been important for me to, I have a reputation for doing, I've done pieces that have about social issues, but I've often used very obscure languages, Sanskrit, Egyptian, sometimes numbers. Latin, Italian, they're so obscure, but for an American audience, they could be. What's really important for me is not only to work with subject matter which is very relevant, which I've been always interested in doing, but to do it in an American language.
And a very colloquial one, I think.
Yeah, and for me, Alan's writing is a kind of a godsend for that purpose, because it is, in fact, sometimes in the Wishita Sutra, in the Wishita Vortex piece, you talk about inventing an American language.
Yeah.
You know, we were talking yesterday, and Alan, you were talking about how language and music had gotten separated, and
since the times of Homer and Sappho, you know,
and
the Greek
in a way,
plays.
Sometimes, if we can just to bring them together in again, and it can be such a powerful it's such a powerful effect when they do come together.
Ellen, you've actually been using music for your poems for years now. Not
kind
all
of
the
amateur,
time, but
you
often.
Know, kind of amateur rhyme ballads and blues and things like that.
Does it give you any new insights into your poems to hear Philip Glass's music?
Yeah, actually, it frames them kind of shining in silver in sort of dignified way, so you get the highlights, the highlights of poems or whole poems which are presented, rather than just sort of sitting there on the page or some byproduct of beatnik frenzy. They're actually presented in a dignified, straightforward way so that an audience can hear it, hear the words, take it seriously, and see it in the context of art rather than some kind of personal
like
neurosis.
Like taking your photographs and putting them in frames and putting them in a museum.
Yeah. It makes kind of museum pieces or operatic pieces out
Maybe
of it.
Maybe that isn't so good.
Well, no, I don't. My impulse is operatic.
Uh-huh.
You know, but melodrama. We were talking about the word melodrama.
Yeah.
My impulse is melodramatic, to dramatize melodically certain moments of recollection or perception, like Aunt Rose. That's melodramatic. I mean, you wake up in Paris and say, oh, my old aunt in Newark 18 years ago, and she's under the grave.
You know, one of the things you both have in common is that you're both Buddhists, yes?
Yes.
And another thing you have both in common is that you're both born Jewish.
And both of probably Eastern European or Middle European parents.
Probably our grandfathers live within a few miles of each other.
My grandfather sold peace goods to your grandmother.
Something like
that. Somewhere near the Lithuanian border.
Oh. Allen Ginsberg, can I ask you to read another excerpt of the poems that are in Hydrogen Jukebox? And this is the second poem.
Yeah, toward the beginning of the opera, and actually
it's an excerpt of a longer poem, isn't it?
Right. It's from Iron Horse from 67, and it's really actually a timely now with the switcheroo from the Cold War, or going back and forth in the Cold War, to say war on drugs, or a war on the underclass, or a war on porn, or war on. Who's the enemy? Year after year, war after war. Who's the enemy? What's the weapon? Battle after battle. What's the news? Defeat after defeat. What's the picture? Decade after decade. Who's the enemy? Year after year.
Philip, do you want to say anything about the music you wrote for this poem?
Well, this is one of the first pieces that I worked on, and when I began working on this, I really wasn't sure how the words and the music were going to match up, and how this was one of the ones that convinced me that I was going to be able to carry out the project, because it's one where the setting for the music came so easily for me.
It's one of the most beautiful pieces in the opera, I think.
Mm-hmm.
This one you've almost made into a chant because it repeats itself.
Well, I repeated it in reading it, actually.
Yeah. You both have drawn on international influences in your work. And I'm wondering, with Glasnost, with the changes that are happening in the Soviet Union and Eastern Europe, if your traveling has changed at all, your sense of your ability to travel, your sense of where your audiences are, who can read, who can perform your work?
Well, my work kind of traveling, let's say working internationally, has been going on for so long now, since the early 70s, that I don't know that the recent events have impacted on it so directly, though now there are possibilities of working in Eastern Europe and that there weren't so much before. I would say for me, it's too soon to say what those differences will be. I've preferred, actually, to tell you the truth, I like working in America. I like working at home. I always felt a bit of an exile during the 70s when I was doing so much work abroad.
Mm-hmm. I've been feeling that the fruition of a lot of the spiritual art of America of the 60s and 70s is coming now in Eastern Europe and in the totalitarian countries as the totalitarian regimes are being overthrown. And in my own situation, my own poetry is now being liberated to be performed and broadcast. So later this month, I'm going to Prague. Well, there'll be, at the end of April, a whole evening of my poetry related to the May King festivals.
Alan, isn't it ironic that you're having these battles with the FCC at home at the same time?
Yeah, it's really amazing. Just as my poetry can be broadcast in Prague or even Moscow, and I have a sort of hit record of Howl in Hungary, mm-hmm. in the Hungarian language, my poetry has been banned by Jesse Helms with the new infamous law, again, barring indecent language 24 hours a day on the airwaves, which has now effectively chilled most of my poetry off National Public Radio and Pacifica and listener-supported stations. All the poems that are in the Norton Anthology and the Oxford Anthology no longer can be broadcast because of the new FCC chilling regulations.
Mm-hmm. One last question about your collaborations together. When you're performing together, can you pick out in the audience who's more so the Ginsberg fan and who's more so the Glass fan?
I can't really. Sometimes when we do these pieces together, these concerts together, I'll play for a part of the program and Alan will read for part of the program. But I look at the audience and it looks like the audiences I generally see anyway. There are a lot of young people come to these and Alan has a very big following among young people. We both do.
Phil's got all those people in the audience with nose rings and golden earrings long hair and punk costumes. And I have all the Jewish Altacockers with gray hair and beards that are nodding sympathetically at East European high culture.
No, the beatniks are all Alan's.
They are not. the acid heads are all yours. We divvy it up.
Well, Alan Ginsberg, Philip Glass, thanks a lot for talking with us.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Alan Ginsberg and Philip Glass's collaboration, Hydrogen Jukebox, will have its concert premiere this month at the American Music Theater Festival in Philadelphia, and its world premiere next month at the Spoleto Festival. Today, Alan Ginsberg is in Washington, D.C., participating in a discussion on FCC regulation of broadcast speech. Ginsberg is speaking against the Helms Amendment, which prohibits the broadcast of indecent material anytime during the broadcast day. This is Fresh Air. Linda Wertheimer is with us to tell us what's coming up on All Things Considered. Linda, what kind of information do you have on the possibility of a hostage release?
News organizations in Lebanon have been notified, Terry, that within 48 hours, one of the American hostages will be released. We don't know who, but the indication is that the hostage has been held for 3 years, which would point to one of the American university hostages. The Supreme Court has issued some important rulings, one on the Kansas City desegregation case and an Ohio case on child pornography, which is a very important decision. We'll also talk to Mary Del Lasser. She's 90 years old now, and some of her children's books about the American wilderness are being reissued.
Thanks, Linda. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Computer word processing has changed the way writers think of their work. Linguist Jeffrey Nunberg was an early and enthusiastic convert to the new technology, but now he's beginning to have second thoughts.
Computers seem to turn writing into a purely cerebral act. They disconnect the process from all contact with a physical page. You can build up a text as fast as your fingers can move and in a tentative electronic form that is infinitely tolerant of revision. That's why children find it an easier way to learn to write. It frees them from the slow and painful process of shaping the letters one by one. And they can make changes without messing up the page, so when they're finished, they can print out a neat copy and give it to their parents to attach to the refrigerator door. For adult writers, it seems wonderfully liberating at first. It's only after you've been corrupted that you realize what's been lost. The 18th century French essayist Joseph Joubert once observed that good writing requires a natural facility and an acquired difficulty. But few writers have these virtues in equal measure. On the one hand, there are those natural writers whose exuberance carries them along effortlessly from one idea to the next. It's hard to imagine George Sand laboring over a sentence, or Whitman getting up in the middle of the night to change an and to an or. But in earlier times, there was always the physical medium to hold their impetuosity in check, to make them pause for an instant. Shakespeare had a stop to dip his quill in the inkwell. Jack Kerouac had to lift his fingers from the typewriter keyboard long enough to hit the carriage return or change the page. But now the naturals can write at something like the speed of thought itself. Their fingers fly over the keys without impediment, and the sentences wind their way anacoluthically down the screen like streams running down a mountain gully, bouncing from bank to bank wherever the course of thought leads them next, and never collecting themselves for a minute to see where they're going, or was the subject back there a singular or a plural, but anyway it scrolled clear off the top of the screen by now and going on like that until the reader's eyes light up with a little sign that says disk space full. Then there are the writers you could think of as stylists. They're the descendants of James and Flaubert, the writers they used to show in movies surrounded by crumpled pieces of paper. Peter Kennell once said that stylists were both the heroes and victims of literature. But once they, too, had the medium to save them from themselves. There's only so much crossing out you can do before a paragraph becomes illegible, only so much whiteout that a page can absorb before it begins to decompose. At some point, you simply have to get on with it. Now their drafts pile up invisibly on the disk. Cutting and pasting, they lay waste their powers. Sentences once baroque become rococo in the search for a perfect felicity of expression that seems, for all the increasing convolution of their clauses, for all the recondity of their diction, persistently to elude them. And when they come to printing out, there's a new round of choices about fonts, margins, formats, headers, footnotes. The technology offers the opportunity for agonies of indecision that James and Proust could only have dreamed about. The future of writing looks bleak. The stylist will produce nothing at all, and the unchecked ramblings of the naturals will be wholly unreadable. The only place we can look for help is from the Save the Trees people. The clean air movement got Detroit to produce smaller cars, after all. In the future, maybe the environmentally correct word processing system will have a slower chip, a smaller memory, a keyboard that sticks. At the least, they could add warning lights, like the indicators on cars that tell you when you should shift gears for fuel efficiency. I don't need much. Just a little add-on module that notices when I've been futzing for 10 minutes over the same sentence and flashes up a message that says, stop beating it to death.
Jeffrey Nunberg is a linguist associated with the Institute for Research on Learning in Palo Alto, California. Phyllis Myers, Joan Tui, and Amy Sallet produced the interviews on Fresh Air with research assistance from Lisa McCullough. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs, 1-800-225-8200. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we meet theater and film director Peter Brook. He staged the epic 9-hour adaptation of the Indian sacred text, The Mahabharata. Now he's adapted the story again for film. Also, we journey to Ground Zero and Frontier New York with photographer Jan Stoller. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.